So some of you may have noticed these past few days a slight change in your energetic quality of the mind. What sense of, not for all of you, but most of you, that the retreat, the special conditions of this time we have together are drawing to a close. So for anybody who doesn't know what I'm talking about, then congratulations. You've won. You've accomplished something difficult to accomplish. Sort of imagining a meditator at the end of a retreat, or, you know, the teacher rings the bell and says, "Okay, that's it. Pack your bags, go home." So what? Oh, really? No idea. Since, as far as I understand it, all of you have been on retreats like this, and you've probably experienced this quality before, a sense of the mind beginning to move forward. And for me, in my experience, it's not a very comfortable thing. It's sort of, there can be a lot of fighting against that. Come on, no, it's not over yet, you know. Stay with it. And yet there can also be, speaking from my own experience, a sense of almost delight in what's going to come, something that's going to change. And that can also be, you know, fear. Fear can come up around that as well. But it's something that that we're quite accustomed to, that looking forward to, planning. I have to, I'm going to, I will, I better. And that's just part of our life. It's part of the way that our minds work. And it's what we've been doing for the last month, is trying to just be aware of it, but not necessarily having a sense of annihilating it or getting away from it. This is just what our minds do. And perhaps when we, you know, before the retreat began, this was something we were sometimes aware of, you know, very aware of, just, you know, planning for the retreat, getting ready for the retreat. And perhaps we were telling our friends and relatives, "I'm going on this 1 month retreat. So I'm gonna go really deep on this one. It's gonna be really profound. I can feel it." And, you know, I'm gonna really delve with some of these difficulties I've been having, and so then we get on the retreat, and maybe we were right about the difficulties, but sometimes we overestimate the peace or the non-dukkha that we experience. I liken this to sometimes how, when I, you know, when I was younger, we had these exams. I think you know about the ACT, SAT for college entrance, and they used to be pretty regular. You didn't use a computer with them. You just filled in answers to questions that basically determined the rest of your life. And if you got anything wrong, then you were just stricken to hell and you were never going to be successful and a failure. But it's interesting how it changed, that nowadays it's all done on computer. And what was fascinating to me was that somebody who gets the results of their exam, this is for the most part, I'd say 99% of people, they might have a very low score. And somebody who gets the results of these exams, they might have a very high score. And both people will usually say the same thing. That was incredibly difficult. Really, 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 really difficult. And it's strange, you know, how does somebody who gets a very low score and somebody who gets a very, very high score, even almost perfect score, say that it was difficult? And that's because when it went to being on computer, every wrong answer that one gets, one then the computer, the algorithms are determining, okay, I better not up the ante too much and ask harder questions. So basically, when people start getting at a level of 50% wrong, then it keeps the level the same, and that's how it determines the score. Whereas somebody who's doing just keeps answering the questions correctly, then the algorithm keeps bumping up the difficulty level, so that somebody who has a near-perfect score won't get up to that 50% wrong mark until they're at like incredible high difficulty. And so for each of us, we have our own path and the ways that each of us are working with our own difficulties and problems. And so sometimes we want to compare ourselves to others or think that, you know, this retreat's going to be different than other retreats and I'm going to, you know, do so well, but we don't really know what's going to come up for us. We don't know the particular depths that we're going to be able to delve into and what's going to come up for us. I mean, for some it might be just this is the most boring retreat I've ever had in my life, or this is so exciting, I was looking forward to every one of Ajahn Suchito's talks. They were just so amazing and so enjoyable, and I had the best retreat ever, it was amazing. Others, oh, it's the worst thing, worst experience of my life. And yet we're all on the same retreat. And it's interesting that somebody who says, oh, this is the worst retreat of my life, they might have actually learned a lot more than the person who said this was the best experience. We don't know, you know, we kind of think sometimes as like with difficulties that arise that, oh, that means that I'm doing poorly, you know, or oh, such an easy retreat, it was so nice, I was just in these pure blissful, you know, I just had all these blissful experiences and it was just one jhana after the next, and well, maybe you got lucky, maybe you had some past karma, and now you think you're the best meditator in the world, so you're going to suffer, you know, around that. I can't get these jhanas back anymore. It was that one perfect, amazing retreat. 2022, Ajahn Suchito. Never again. So I'll have to go on the 2024 retreat with Ajahn Suchito, and then I'll get those jhanas back. Or whenever it is. But this is the kind of thing that we do, is we're often not aware of our own experience because we're judging it all the time. We're kind of putting it under a microscope, and it's very hard to see, you know, like what is actually changed, what's going on here. And one of the problems with especially the end is that we get into this very typical mindset of, okay, now I have to plan everything out. I got to get my life to be exactly as it is on the retreat when it finishes. So when I go back home, it's like nothing changes. I'm meditating the same amount of time, walking very slowly, you know, noting every single, you know, mouthful, and everything will be perfect. Maybe I'll have almond butter, though, instead of peanut butter. That'll be better for me. You know, whatever it is. And then you see that the mind starts to then incline towards something, and that's like, oh yeah, I'm going to tell so-and-so about this, and all right, and then I'm going to, oh right, dinner. I have to have dinner again. Whatever it is, we start to build on the future. And there's nothing wrong with this. It's what we've been doing since I think we started to divide the world when we were infants, and we started learning about just how different things are and how to interpret our experience. But our problem is that we very much fight against this and think that it's a sense of like who and what we are. I'm a bad person for having these plans, or I should know better, or whatever it is. And the problem is that we're not seeing that this is just bhava tanha, this is just the normal aspect of becoming, that to a certain extent we've been able to slow down to a degree during the retreat, but we've had these very special conditions to do that. And a retreat is, you know, these are under very special conditions, and they can be approximated in non-retreat life, but they can't be duplicated. You know, we do have to deal with bills and other people and future plans and cars breaking down and adversity. And so that's the challenge we want to engage with, is to know that this becoming is happening, and you know, it's kind of mixed in with vibhava tanha, this sort of non-becoming as well, this sort of like, oh, I just want to get me out of here, or I don't want to do this, or I'd rather not. And also, as I was mentioning as well, like, we start to turn a little bit more towards sensuality, because there are, in a situation like this, you know, we've only had 3 choices of salad dressings. One day there was 4. It was really confusing. But now there's 822, you know, and then we start making our own, and all of these things happen. So, you know, how to do this skillfully, though, how to engage with an ending of a retreat, an ending of a certain way that we have been experiencing ourselves, and beginning a new way that encourages us to do this with wisdom, but also with the knowledge like, okay, well, there are always difficulties that come up, you know, and there's no way to avoid that. I mean, talking to people who weren't on the retreat, and even if they have a sense of what it is we're doing, you know, they're not going to be having had the same rhythms. So there's a divide. Is that typical sense people ask, like, oh, how was your retreat? And then 10 minutes later, like, oh my God, will this person stop talking? I just wanted to know how, like, was it good or bad? And, of course, it's not that simple, but it's hard. We wanna be able to talk with other people, but it's not as easy in that vein as well. So sometimes we just learn to keep it a bit private. Oh, yeah, it was a good retreat. I learned some of this and that. And if people want more, then they'll ask for more. But the thing that we want to encourage in ourselves, I think, that's so important, is that we're transitioning, and we have an opportunity right now to not only learn about that transition, but to do it with as much skill as we can. You know, as much as what we've gained over the last month, there's a lot of wisdom that's been brought to the fore, and we can actually use that. So I think one of the things that's very helpful right now, again, if I'm shattering anybody's sense that there was an end, I'm sorry, but there is probably going to be an end of this retreat. And, you know, how to actually work with that over the next couple of days, rather than resist it or do the opposite, you know, look forward to it. Look forward to this transition. Oh, how do I maintain what Ajahn Suchito has been teaching all along, and what I've been doing with my own Dhamma practice for the many years before this? How do I actually use this momentum of the mind, the energetic quality of the mind that's changing, in a way to understand the Dhamma? So as I mentioned, one way is not to persecute ourselves. It's not to say, you know, it shouldn't be this way, or I should be able to handle this by now. This should be something that I'm a master of it at this point, you know, ending a retreat, or coming off of a retreat, or re-entering the world, or even thinking about it. We might chastise ourselves for thinking like, what, you know, why do I have this change in momentum? Why can't I just keep the retreat going into the last second? And this sort of sense of what the mind's doing. And that's because, you know, we can't. That's not actually what the Buddha was teaching us. It wasn't a denial of experience. Or like a, you know, strangling experience saying, no, it has to be this way, it shouldn't be that way. So through, of course, embodiment, through really bringing it into our own sense of our own experience, our bodily experience, our citta, our heart, we say, well, this is how it is. This is our experience. And as Lumpur Sumedho teaches with this, it's just you just use that one phrase and you can say it over and over again to yourself, and it has so much profundity. It's incredible. Just, it's like this. So it's really so helpful, because dukkha is really the representation of it shouldn't be like this. Or we say it's not like this. And so it's quite an opportunity to really bring that up for ourselves. And to know, like, the what we're learning here is not to have a better experience. It's not to like just feel better or make everything sort of see the world in pink and just make ourselves essentially just like happy and blissful all the time. It's to know that, you know, when we're not happy, that we're not happy. Or when we're frustrated, we're frustrated. Or that this is anxiety. This is very normal. And so what the Buddha was talking about when he was saying, you know, don't torture yourself. It's like, our tendency can often be like, no, but yeah, I'm anxious, but I shouldn't be such an anxious person. I should be better than that. You know, so we try to kill our fear, or worse, we tell ourselves that we're not a good person for having it. I've been meditating for 25 years. How can I still experience fear? Or this is the 27th retreat I've finished, and how could I still, you know, even care that there's an ending? Or I don't care that there's an ending. What's he talking about? This talk is very irritating to me. So it's like this. And so one of our goals in terms of, I think, ending when retreats end or going on retreat is to also have a sense of ending it well. And, you know, I also want to address the fact that, of course, it's just changing circumstances. We can say, well, there really isn't an ending of a retreat. It's just sort of a change in postures. It's a change in what we're doing, we don't have to necessarily see it like an end. But, you know, we are actually packing our bags and leaving. Not everyone, but most of us. This reminds me of a famous story that I probably won't get right because I'm not the one who is the main character in it. Ajahn Sucitta was. But there was a time when, you know, like we're about to engage in a 3-month retreat in most of our monasteries in Europe and Americas and Australia. And so these 3-month retreats that we have, sometimes they're preceded by about like a week or so or some amount of time where it's just a quiet time in the monastery. And so there was a time when this pre-retreat week or whatever it was, 5 days, 3 days, it was kind of unclear. It was just like, okay, we're just going to stop work and people can kind of wrap up their business and prepare for the retreat. But the retreat start date wasn't announced. And it wasn't said like, okay, we're going to do this for a week. It's just, we're going to have a little time. And so, as I understand it, one of the monks or very junior members of the community went up to Ajahn Sucitta after a few days and said, Ajahn, has the retreat begun? I mean, are we on retreat now? Has it started? Has it begun? And he said, well, for some of us, the retreat has begun. And for others, it never will. And so I would think this kind of junior member walked away a bit bewildered. Which one am I? I'm not sure. And so we can take a page from that and also say, you know, about this retreat. It's that, you know, the for some of us the retreat has already ended, and for others it never will. But in terms of it never will, that would be more a sense of seeing like, okay, I think more of an acceptance that the conditions are changing. You know, these are very special conditions. But it doesn't have to be a black or white kind of transition, you know, a sort of one of extremes, a kind of it ends and then I am a new person or I'm doing this or I'm doing that. So what we can say is, yes, that these conditions are ending, and then while they're ending, you know, how do we use this, as I was saying, with wisdom, this kind of transition? And so if our past uses of this time have been, I'm going to do this, that differently, and then I'm going to reschedule my entire day, every day, for the rest of my life now. A 3-hour sit in the morning, and then a 5-hour sit in the evening, and I'll do a lot of walking in between, and then, oh yeah, I have to do some yoga as well. Oh, and the new Qigong I've learned, that's right, yeah. Oh, my forgiveness practice, I want to do that, right? And right, in the appreciation practice, I have to do that. Oh, metta, I forgot about metta. Yeah, I got to do at least 3 or 4 hours of metta a day. That'll even out. And oh, right, there's this whole old age thing. I guess I'm aging. I should probably work that in there. And the dying, yeah. Definitely dying. Okay, so that's 48 hours in 24. I'm going to do that. So that, you know, this is the tendency is like, how can I create my perfect after retreat experience, and you haven't even finished the retreat and it's still going on. And I remember, you know, I just remember this happens every time I have this separation from the community in terms of this retreat time. There a lot of times in the monasteries we'll have opportunities to do what's called a solitary retreat, which means that you don't have any responsibilities. You can come to the meal. You cannot come to the meal. You can just do what you want with your practice, as long as you're practicing. And then all of a sudden it ends, and you're back into becoming. And that's what often happens. I'm the guest monk, or I'm the vice abbot, or I'm the work monk, or we step into these roles, and then that becomes us, or we become that. And so I think what's important is, over these next couple of days, to kind of try to gather one's wits, you know, to really kind of say, well, what can I do differently with this ending that I haven't done in the last times that I've ended a retreat? And maybe this has been a skill that's been built upon over the last many years, how to transition. So you can still find something, I think, that can be valuable in this. It might even be, oh, well, the mind's actually not engaging in that much becoming. It's not engaging in as much as I usually do engage with at the end of the retreat. There's not so much activity. What's that about? Did I do something? Has something changed? And so we keep coming back to that embodiment. What is here right now? What's present for us? For myself, in my experience now, what you know, I'm just noticing my own mind and the inclinations I have towards going back to Bhagiri. So the current abbot, Ajñānikō, he's departing on a 7-month sabbatical. 7-month sabbatical, and he said, "Okay, you're in charge, Chunda." Oh, so that's, you know, that's been this kind of, it's been sort of hovering over the mind, if you will, over the retreat. And I might have mentioned this to Ajahn Chitto and Tansi Nato on the Garganathan. But that's what's come up. It's like, oh, what am I going to do about this? How am I going to lead? How am I going to deal with this? And of course the mind then moves into like, oh, I'm going to. I'm going to make the monastery much better than it was. And everybody's going to be happy and be really, they're just going to say that my leadership was so amazing, just so great, and they're going to establish me as the abbot of a new monastery somewhere else, which would be awful. But the you know, the there's a sense of like, you know, it, truthfully speaking, like, oh, it's there's going to be something I'm going to do that's going to be good or better, or I'm going to do this and it's going to have this result. And it's just it's comical, because it's like, no, A, I don't know if I'm going to do that, and B, it's not going to have any result that I think it's going to have, because it never works out that way. But the mind wants to create solidity. It wants to say, okay, it wants to create a known future, something that's clear and present, and or not present in this case. It's just something that I can predict. It's predictable. It's controllable. And it's good. It's not like I'm planning for a disaster. Like, I can't wait till everything turns out to be a disaster. This is going to be great. No, it's like, well, I'm going to do this, and it's going to work out. And the irony is how many times that sentiment occurs. You know, I'm not sure if it's the same for you, but the sense of like predicting and planning, and then it's going to be, you know, it's going to turn out just amazing. It's going to be happily ever after. There's no, there's not going to be any problems anymore. And just, yeah, that's incredible, because it's just like the biggest lie that's ever existed. It just doesn't work out that way. And sometimes it works out in a different way, and it's better. And sometimes it works out in the way exactly as planned, and it's worse. So the sense is, though, like, okay, how can I be aware of that and move forward with wisdom? And so I can keep coming back to the sense of, okay, this is what the mind does. It's natural, it's normal, it just plans, it creates, it has an incredibly strong propensity towards prediction and control. You know, this is why when the Buddha talks about the three characteristics, you know, he's really, you know, Nietzsche is one of the things. We want to say that things are permanent, that they have a lasting quality to them that's unchanging. As many of you know, Ajahn Chah used to, he had a more turn of phrase with that. He said, not sure. So Nietzsche, which is usually translated as permanence, and Anicca is impermanent, and Ajahn Chah said, well, actually, it's our sense of wanting fixedness and surety, and kind of a sense that this is, I can predict this, that we have to be very careful with. So we just introduce that phrase, not sure. And so it's quite helpful, because at the same time that we're trying to embody our own experience, we're trying to sense our chittas, a sense of our heart, what's present for us, we need to do some analysis as well. You know, we need to do some reflection. Because the heart reveals what's present for us, but then we use the Dhamma, we use what we've learned to analyze that. So our stories, you know, might have that sense, you know, what's happening now on the retreat is different. I'm going to be doing X, Y, and Z, and I have to plan for my plane trip, and who I'm going to see, and who I have to call in order to make arrangements. I'm just not sure. And what do you do when you get to the airport and your flight is canceled? So the, you know, the first thing is, I can't believe this. How could they do this to me? You know, but what we're learning is more like, oh, okay, well, this is still painful. There's no denial in the pain of things changing, of things not being the way we want. But we're still, we have a quality of wisdom with that. Oh, that's right. This is all not sure. So I plan, okay, I'm going back to Vaigiri. I get there, and then Ajahn Yanaka says, I have to talk to you about something. And I say, you know, what's that? He says, well, actually, you're not aware of this, but the plane crashed while you're trying to get back to California. You're actually in the afterlife, and you are. So, oh, really? Wow. Yeah, I'm just an emanation of Brahma, and just to tell you, oh, wow, I didn't guess. I thought you were going to tell me I wasn't going to be the abbot. But that's, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities. That one probably won't be one of them. But it's possible that, you know, I could, yeah, get back to Vaigiri, and then everyone's dead. And then there won't be anybody to actually have to worry about. But I could get back there, and Ajahn Yanaka said, actually, I talked to the community, and there was a lot of thoughts, actually, maybe it wouldn't be so good for you to do this. And, And so it's funny, because I could have even had a dread of, like, oh, I don't really want to do this, you know. be responsible for all this. You know, I just want to be on retreat for 3 months and then, you know, have somebody else do it. But then all of a sudden there's that, no, the community kind of thinks maybe it'd be better we have somebody else. Oh, this knife wound to the heart. How could you? And this little voice says, I thought you didn't really want to do this. Sort of like, and that's how it is. It's just like, no, it's the prediction. It's the control. It's the sense of I know who I am and what I am and what I'm doing. That's what's important. That I have something predictable. Even if it's something I don't like or I don't want, it's something that I can rely on. It's going to happen. I know it's going to be just like this. Or the irony in that situation is it's like something maybe I don't actually want to do, but then all of a sudden there's rejection involved. There's like other people. And then that was supposed to be predictable. Like what? People don't like me now? How did that happen? I thought being liked was supposed to be stable over time, you know, just everybody likes you, everything's cool, everything's fine. But it's, you know, it's never that way. This somebody, you know, who adores you then wakes up in a bad mood and you're like the devil to them. Like, how did that happen? Because it's always changing. So, you know, with these last couple of days now, then we have a sense, all right, this just keeps changing. My moods fluctuate. You have a sense of the other people that you've been living with for a month, and you may not see them again or for a long time. Or maybe you'll see too much of them, you know, and then that's a dread or something like that. Or something to look forward to. I can't wait. I can't wait until. So as I've been talking about these things, these are all ways to kind of illustrate for yourself, you know, what's going on for you, what's present for you. And I think what's helpful is just to ask the question, you know, how can I do this a little differently? How can I do this with a little more wisdom so that the transition, this current transition that I'm in, if the retreat is ending, again, there's a few of you who it is not quite over. And I'll remind you, it's not actually over. There's still a couple more days left. How do you, you know, what is there to work with then? How to transition well? Some people talk about the good death, you know, how to die well. From the body's perspective, I don't think there's any way to die well. It's pretty messy affair usually. But from the mind's perspective, there is a possibility of ending things well, no matter how difficult they are. And that means that we transition into trying to be aware of the same mistakes that we've made in the past and to be forgiving of ourselves when those same mistakes come up, or even if there are things we thought that we knew how to deal with, but we don't this time around. We just keep on being aware. Well, it's like this. Rather than it being, you know, an opportunity for what some of us are very good at, you know, judging ourselves. So this can be, you know, this can be an ongoing reflection, you know, how do I do this in a beautiful way? You know, because we talk about an ending, we're also talking about a beginning. And, you know, we're also talking about, as I began the talk with bhava tanha, that sense of becoming, you know. Unless one is an arahant, there is no end to this sense of me and mine and what I will be and how I'll be and what I have to do. But when we're aware of it, then we can stem the flow of it. We can stem the flow of becoming. But that doesn't mean, you know, the outflows just end right there. It just means that we know how to slow it down. So we're used to our patterns. We're used to our typical behaviors. And oh, there it is again. Okay. How can I slow that one down? Just the last night, I was coming into the hall, but before I was going down a very long hallway, and I thought, oh, I really, you know, 3 minutes early is actually 3 minutes late, so I better get in there fast. And so I really started picking it up, and then one of you kind of came to came the opposite direction towards me, and I was like, oh, that's not very inspiring of me. I better slow down. So that's that sense of wanting to go, wanting to get. That, you know, that also affects others, and it certainly affects our own minds. But there's, you know, there's at the same time, there's nothing punishable about it. There's nothing kind of, I mean, this is praise from a worldly sense, you know. Look at him go. Wow, he really works hard. Running here, running there. But we're consistently trying to conduce towards our own happiness. We're trying to support our own well-being. And so then it's not just a sense of like, oh, this is not so inspiring for other people. It's like, oh, what is inspiring for me? What is helpful for me? What's the best thing that I can do for myself right now? Because usually when we're very aware of that, what's the right thing for me to do, and it's not coming from a selfish motive, then almost all the time then it's usually the right thing for other people. It's not something that is taking advantage of others or getting in the way of other people or having a sense of greed, hatred, or delusion. So we're kind of inviting the skillful, we're inviting that which is wholesome into our experience. And so as this transition is occurring, then that sense of invitation is very important. We call it like a puarana in Pali. It's like inviting. So I really want to encourage that over these next couple of days, and for those who are actually leaving the forest refuges, okay, this is a inviting quality of sense of, you know, what's present for me now. The causes and conditions are changing. And so how can I be present with that, not make a problem out of it, and then use it for insight? And the more we're able to do that, then miraculously, then the transition becomes much easier. So we stop kind of moving into looking forward to, or, you know, kind of turning back. I wish it would last longer, I wish it was more like this, or I wish I should have done that, or I will do this, and we just stay in that center. It's the center of that whirlwind that we can often be caught up in. The center of a hurricane is actually a very calm point or spot, which is fascinating if you think about it. It's just this incredibly violent violent winds and movement, but yet right in the center is just this calm, unmoving point. And so that's what we want for ourselves, because the conditions out there, they're always changing. And so we wanna remain in the center. So the mind isn't just automatically going out. And that doesn't mean that we don't plan. It doesn't mean that we don't have to engage with the conditions, but it's where we're coming from. It's that stability within that allows us to be with these different experiences but not be so moved by them. So over these next couple of days, I just invite you to try to maybe use that phrase of Lumpur Samedo, it's like this. And you can possibly sometimes see the resistance to that, since it shouldn't be like this, or I wish it was some other way. But when we surrender to that, we let go. We're no longer holding on to the way we wish it should be, or wish it could be. Then we find that stability in these changing conditions to be a place of wisdom, understanding, and a sense that we have, oh right, there's not as much suffering when I stay in. When the mind isn't leaping out to the next thing. It's just like this beautiful pause. And then there is that sense of freedom that can occur in that moment. It's the freedom not to be drawn out. I find for myself that's where the Buddha's teaching on faith comes in, because faith, in the way that the Buddha taught it, was meant actually confidence. And so when you've penetrated a sort of sense of the mind not needing to move out, and you've actually have done something like that, you've used a turn of phrase just like that, it's like this, and then the mind pauses, it stays in, and there might be, you know, you might see very clearly, oh no, it wants to move. There's an inclination towards something. I have to get this, or I don't want that. But the mind just stays where it is. And there's what's called chanda. There's a desire for that. It's a wholesome desire. All right, this is what the experience of non-suffering is. This is the flavor of non-suffering. And the more we get acquainted with it and we have a taste of that sense of what it's like, then we incline towards it. And the harder part is that magnetically, because of our past karma, we are very much drawn towards samsara, we're drawn towards the world of becoming and non-becoming and sensuality. It's just a very natural drawing. And so we're doing something that really goes against that. And I don't know anybody yet who I've encountered who said, you know, just like these college entrance exams, oh, it's easy. This Dhamma practice is so easy. As the Buddha remarked, it's the most difficult thing one can do. Easier to conquer the world. But the more that we enjoy that experience of non-suffering, the more that we get acquainted with it, the more that we, you know, become the center of the hurricane. Then that is where our minds incline towards. And so whether our retreat is like this is ending or it's beginning, then our habit we just keep coming back to that center, we keep coming back, withdrawing the mind from the becoming, withdrawing the mind from the sensuality. And that's the taste of freedom. That's the inclination that we can become habituated to, and it becomes very alive and important to us. And it's of course very gradual. It can take lifetimes. So it's not a race, you know. We don't have to compete against anyone. This retreat doesn't have to be a, you know, for some a 9.5 out of 10, and others a 4.2 out of 10. It doesn't have to be a grade we're giving ourselves. It's just that inclination we're continuing to encourage ourselves in. That centering, that pausing, that calm and very quiet point of mind. Where the desire changes. That's why the first stage of enlightenment is called stream entry. Because one enters the stream of Dhamma. Which is going against the stream of the world. But in entering the stream of Dhamma, one is then pulled into it. It's an irreversible entering. So over and over, we just keep on inclining ourselves. That's where we're moving towards. That's our interest. And it's just one step at a time. It's not, you know, it doesn't have to be a heroic attempt. It's that, as I mentioned before, it's that gradual, just like drop by drop, until it's a flow of Dhamma, a stream of Dhamma. So we can continue to engage in our formal practice.